Accessory number 8736, rule number 43.
Harding, tape 43. Did this worry you, the fact that you perceived you didn't have a lot of support in government, you know, in the political parties, that there wasn't a pressure group?
Oh, I had. Don't get me wrong. I had absolute unstinted support from the government. Absolutely complete and unstinted support, both from the Prime Minister and from the Colonial Secretary and from other members of the government as well, and from the Secretary of State for War, of course, all those individually, but generally, I mean, I couldn't have had more support, both from the, well, from everybody, from the Prime Minister, the Foreign Secretary, the Minister of Defence, everybody. But the Labour Party, you see, took a different view. And if I may illustrate that by reference to what happened after Eoka called a ceasefire to their operations in March, March 56. I then estimated that it would take them at least 6 months to... They weren't destroyed. Eoka was not destroyed. You can't destroy an organization of that kind by military means. But they had had a series of severe defeats. They'd had heavy losses of personnel, in relation to their total numbers. And I estimated that it would take them some 6 months to rebuild to an effective guerrilla organization. And I thought that in 6 months, with energetic steps on the part of the government in London, and particularly the Foreign Office, that would be long enough to make sufficient progress in negotiations towards an agreed settlement to obviate anybody resorting to violence again. But progress was very slow, and I got more and more irritated by the delays and starting getting on with negotiations between the three governments concerned. That's our government was the Greek and Turkish government. And then that summer, I think it was in August, at the Labour Party conference, Mrs. Barbara Castle, who had taken an interest in the Cyprus problem, I think in her constituency there were quite a number of people from Cyprus living and voting, but anyway she'd taken in it, and she, it wasn't a formal resolution, but it was a proposal which was put forward at that conference that in the next socialist government they would immediately apply self-determination to Cyprus. And that was passed. It wasn't a formal resolution, but it was passed as a proposal. Well, at that time, Macmillan's government was very low in the opinion polls, and it looked pretty certain that at the next general election, the socialists might defeat the Tories. And so this was duly recorded and noted, of course, in Athens and Ankara. And the Greeks in Athens thought, well, if we're going to get all we're asking for after the next general election in the United Kingdom. Why do we want to give any ground now? And the Turks in Ankara did the same. So both parties went back. This is my version of the story. Both parties went back into their trenches and negotiations broke down. So, in effect, my appreciation and my forecast was proved totally wrong by what had been discussed and apparently decided at the Labour Party conference that summer. And that set the whole thing back again. And by that time, there were no sign of EOCA building up again, and our operations against EOCA had been seriously, very seriously impeded by the Suez operation, which took away the parachute brigade and the Royal Marine Commando brigade. And so it was, we weren't quite back to square one, but we were pushed a long way back. And we had to face the fact that the EOCA would rebuild and become an effective guerrilla force again. And come the following, am I talking about 56 or 57? 56. Come the following year, 57. Which year was Suez? Well, that's right, then it was 56. I was getting, and the EOCA hadn't resumed operations. And I was getting near the end of my 2 years, and I came to the conclusion that the situation was one in which the political factors were predominant. And you needed somebody who was perhaps well-versed and more capable in dealing with political negotiations, because I reckoned that the EOCA had been put out of business at any rate for long enough of negotiations to be successful.
Before we go on to that, you know, the later period, I think I would like to ask you a little more about the 1956 period and EOCA's activities. Could I ask you, first of all, Lord Harding, when you arrived in Cyprus, what was your assessment of the degree of support for this organisation? You know, did you think that the majority of the Greek Cypriots were behind EOCA? Did your assessment alter as time went on?
When I went in my early days there, I thought and hoped that it would be possible for a political leadership and support to arise for negotiating a settlement within the constraints that the London government had imposed. But gradually, as time went on, I lost that hope and came to the conclusion that there was no possibility of an alternative leadership to Makarios being born and developing in Cyprus. And that again was a factor which was in my mind, of course, when I recommended that the Archbishop be deported. I'd given up any, I think, looking back on it all, I had probably given up all hope by that time of an alternative leadership, Greek leadership, coming up, or growing, or developing, or coming into power, or being able to be a firm influence in favour of ending the violence and sitting down and talking. Did that answer your question?
Yes, indeed. Also, did you take any measures towards the communist organisation?
Yes, I did, because I thought that although they weren't being active, they were a force in the background who might well become. And so I proscribed the communist organisation. I mean, that has been the subject of criticism. Why was it done? And I think that's my reason. Is that although it wasn't an active a supporter of IOCA at that time, it was, so to speak, an undercover supporter. And the Akel would have thrown in their lot with IOCA if and when they thought they were going to win. And therefore it was necessary to ban them.
How easy was that to do? Was it a well-planned
perfectly easy to do. I mean, it would just pass an emergency regulation prescribing the organisation.
What happened to the communist leaders?
Well, then you arrested a certain number of them, the prominent leaders of them, and then probably got released later on. No, I think, looking back on it all, it was probably a mistake.
Oh, why do you think that now?
Well, because I don't think it had any real bearing on the eventual outcome of the anti-terrorist operations or of the prospects of a political agreement.
You've explained your policy so far as IOCA was concerned and your methods for dealing with this initially when you went to Cyprus, but I believe there was another arm to your policy. Did you not have some plans for the development of the island to stimulate sort of economic matters there?
Oh, yes, of course. There's a great deal of ignorance about the plans and progress made by the British administration in Cyprus up to the time of the outbreak of the IOCA uprising. A tremendous amount had been done, both with regards to agriculture, forestry, medicine, and so on. And I think this is ignored by present-day critics of the British administration of Cyprus. But a great deal was done, and a great deal of development was done. But there was still a great deal more that could have been done and hadn't been done, but mainly for lack of resources, particularly money. And so I thought, and my officials, advisors agreed that it was important to show that the British government was not just concerned with suppressing IOCA, but was also concerned with the future prosperity of the island and the contentment and happiness of the inhabitants. And that therefore I got agreement from the London government that they would underwrite a large sum of money, I can't remember the amount now, but running into millions, for development, particularly in building reservoirs, in conserving water, in providing water supplies for villages and towns that were without them, for improving other utility services and so on, and this plan was made and put into effect and was promulgated. I don't think it had any direct effect on the support given by the Greek population to IOCA, as I say, either from fear or from sympathy, but it did certainly help towards the development of Cyprus and the improvement of the economy. But that was a positive plan. It was put into effect and it was promulgated and carried through. I can't remember the precise sum now, but I think it was something like 60 million or something of that order. And it was useful, but I don't think it had any marked effect on public opinion, unfortunately.
Is that because the EOCO activity?
I think that was because of the, I suppose, I don't know. It's difficult to understand the psychology. I suppose that it was looked upon by the nationalist Greek and the pro-innocence Greeks as being a sort of bribe. And you know how these things were done, say, for the interests of economic improvement and welfare, are very often are looked upon as bribes. And I think that was really what happened.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because the Americans, you know, the latest offer from the Americans is very similar. They are offering large sums of money for development for Cyprus.
Well, they're developing in their field, aren't they?
Yes.
and in the Turkish part of the country. Yes. And well, I mean, you see, you're competing with a philosophy which is not a very truly felt philosophy, that better poor with Greek motherland than rich with British rule. And that's the sort of slogan that gets around and meets with a lot of approval and support. I don't for the moment say that we shouldn't have embarked on this development program. I think it was the right thing to do, and it was the responsibility of the British government to do so, to provide the funds for it, because hadn't always been that forthcoming in producing funds for the development. That was the story of the Turkish tribute, for example. And it was generally thought rather like, I suppose it's thought about the Falklands, that the Falkland Island Company is the one that benefits most from keeping the Falkland under British sovereignty. No, I don't know. You can get misrepresented, these things, but I think I hoped it would be a useful factor in the thinking of the Greeks in Cyprus. I don't think in the event it turned out to be so.
Could I now ask you about the main problems you had to face regarding the EOCA organization? First of all, their terrorist acts. What did this consist of?
Well, to start with, of course, there was no, as I tried to explain, there was no intelligence about their strengths or their armament or their tactics or their plans. But gradually we got to know, to acquire more and more intelligence. And in the early days of the emergency, their activities were based on what came to be called the mountain gangs. I can't remember how many of them there were, but there were small groups of up to a dozen or so men, I suppose, maybe more, a dozen to 15, under a leader who owned allegiance directly to Grivas, who carried out raids on police stations and on civil services installations, with a view to making government impossible and demoralizing the peace force. And that was the form of activity to start with. In the towns, there were riots, student demonstrations, like the riots that led to the burning of the British Council offices and premises in Nicosia. That was before I arrived, but that sort of thing. It was a combination of raids on police stations and installations by the mountain gangs of groups. There weren't very many of them, I don't know how many, but there were small groups under an individual leader and directly under the command of Grivas. And gradually we got more information about them, who they were. They lived up in the mountains, and they came down into the plains and carried out their raids and so on, and then went back again. Gradually we found out more about them, and we were able to stage operations against them. To start with, these took the form of large-scale sweeps through the forests and the mountains, in one of which the security forces very nearly captured Grivas, but he managed to escape. And they weren't all that successful, but they gradually got the mountain gangs less able to operate, less effective. And then it spread. They spread their activities to the towns, where they organized support groups and killer gangs. And the particularly effective one, of course, was the killer gang in Nicosia, which at one time was headed by Nicholas Sampson, who was a pathological killer, had been a journalist on one of the Cyprus papers, one of the Greek Cyprus papers, I think, and had committed a number of murders of policemen and soldiers. And that activity continued, and that was the cause of the murder of quite a number of soldiers and policemen in the towns. But as we got on top of the mountain gangs, then we had to get on top of the killer gangs in the towns, and that was more difficult because they had good support. I mean, the common trick was that they watch like burglars do, watch carefully what's going on. If anybody made a mistake and did the same thing twice or three times running in the same way at the same time, they were vulnerable. And then a murder took place. And the murder was done by a couple of chaps, perhaps. They had a getaway. They had somebody who took over the guns back in the back streets somewhere. And they were extremely difficult to catch. And police work was very, very difficult. We've got the same sort of thing happening now in Ulster and in other parts of the world. And they are extremely difficult to handle, to get on top of. But gradually we did. And but the student demonstrations and the town riot elements, that died away. And the police were able to get on top of that. So, in the end, we were reduced to the remnants of the mountain gangs and these killer groups. And they were very small, probably only two or three men, supported by a couple of women who were the getaway gang, the parties, in the towns. And the whole thing was this... to get find out who they were, where they were operating, how they were operating, and this, of course, took time and effort. But gradually, he got on top of them, too. But they were never completely eliminated. I mean, take Nicholas Sampson, for example. He was responsible for up to eight or more murders in Nicosia. Eventually, information led to his being located at a village outside Nicosia, and they combined police house of Canterbury group ran into him, and I think a comrade of his, in a house in the village, and there was a gun battle, and he was captured, and he was taken into Nicosia and interrogated. And then he was tried for murder on a confession. And the judge, a British judge it was, who was out there, he decided in his judgment that the confession was not admissible. So by that time, before then, I had made it mandatory on the courts to impose the death penalty, reserving to my right self the right to commute or confirm, impose the death penalty on anyone not only found guilty of murder, but found guilty of being in possession of arms, ammunition, or explosives. So he was retried on the charge of being in possession of arms, ammunition, and explosives. And found guilty and sentenced to death by the judge. But by that happened after Ioka had called a halt to their operations. So I was faced with the problem of deciding whether to hang him or to commute his sentence, in the light of the fact that active operations by Ioka had ceased. Now, the terms of the royal prerogative, which is handed to a governor of a crown colony, are that in deciding whether or not to confirm or commute the sentence of death, the officer who is appointed to exercise the royal prerogative has to have consideration, give consideration, to all factors of a public and a private nature. In this particular case, if I had confirmed the sentence of death on Little Samson, I, after a great deal of thought, came to the conclusion that this would give Ioka reason, an opportunity for restarting their operations, which was something I was anxious to avoid for political reasons, because I thought that that would hinder attempts to reach a political agreement and the negotiations that then in progress, not very fast, but in progress. And so I decided to commute the sentence to one of life imprisonment, with the proviso that he served his sentence in the UK, and he was sent back to England and imprisoned in Wormwood Scrubs. When the amnesty agreement was finally reached, independence was granted, and an amnesty was declared, he was released, and within a matter of weeks, he committed another murder. So what?
He later achieved quite a high position, didn't he, in Cyprus?
What?
Did he not achieve a high position?
Well, he was the guy who was made the puppet of the Greek colonel's attempt to depose Makarios and...